forgot to check. We're good to go. All right, let's call this meeting of the Senate Judiciary Committee to order. It is 1:31 p.m. and it is Wednesday, April 26th. Before we begin, I want to thank Joanna Crossett, the Senate Judiciary Secretary, who makes sure we have a transcript of our meetings, and Doug Bridger from the Juno LIO, who makes sure we have sound. At this time, I want to remind committee members and those in the room to please silence your cell phone. Present today, we have Senator Kaufman, Senator Giesel. My vice chair, Senator Keel, is absent, and myself, Senator Klayman. We have a quorum to conduct business. Our first and order only of business today is a follow-up hearing on the Department of Justice investigation of the state of Alaska's behavioral health system for children. We have multiple individuals present today to offer invited testimony. First, we're going to hear from representatives of the Department of Health. First, Dr. Ann Zink, Chief Medical Officer from the Department of Health, and Heather Carpenter, Policy Advisor from the Department of Health. If you both please come forward, identify yourselves for the record, and make your presentation. We'll follow. And I'd also note, I believe available online for questions are Farina Brown, Acting Director, Division of Behavioral Health, Department of Health, Lynn Kyleman-Cruz, Acting Deputy Director, Division of Senior and Disability Services, Department of Health, and Chris Robison, Special Litigation Attorney, Civil Division, Department of Law. Dr. Zink, Ms. Carpenter, please identify yourselves and please proceed.
For the record, Heather Carpenter, Healthcare Policy Advisor at the Department of Health. I will just note that while the presentation does mention Deputy Commissioner Emily Ritchie, as is often happens this time of year, she is in a different committee on other state business at this time.
For the record, I'm Dr. Ann Zink. I'm the Chief Medical Officer for the State of Alaska, and we want to thank Chair Klayman as well as the members of the Judiciary Committee for having this meeting today. Today, we will outline the work that is happening with the State of Alaska, some of which is not reflected in the DOJ report, as well as outline what timely and intentional path forward we have to address the needs of behavioral health needs of children. We would like to note that this is not our legal response to the Department of Justice, but instead it's our goal that the State of Alaska has compassionate, appropriate, accessible and timely care for every Alaska child. And to get there, it's going to take all of us. We look forward to this partnership and taking questions at the end. When we look at the different services that are provided and needed for the behavioral health system in Alaska, there's four major pillars: Medicaid, general funds, grants, and other payers, such as private insurance, as well as out-of-pocket care. The Department of Justice report primarily focused on Medicaid, and so that's what we'll spend the majority of our time talking about. But we do believe it's important to note that the balance between all four of these pillars do determine if we have services or if people can access them within the state of Alaska and need to be thought of collectively. To look at one in isolation will miss the big picture, and the solutions that are needed will take the whole state. So to focus more on Medicaid, I will turn it over to Heather Carpenter.
Senator Giesel.
Do you want questions during your presentation or after? What would you prefer?
We'd prefer questions at the end, if that's okay with you all. We tried to make it very short, so there's...
Thank you.
For the record, Heather Carpenter, and just going back to slide two for a second, just honing in on this Medicaid pillar, I want to remind the committee, as well as those who may be watching, that there are three funding structures that really exist in our state under Medicaid. So we have our state plan services. That is where you might hear us talk about a SPA or a state plan amendment. That's kind of the bulk of how we pay for Medicaid. We also have two different flavors of waivers. We have 1915C home and community-based service waivers. Those are the ones you often hear about when the KEY campaign comes to town to advocate for eradicating the wait list. Those are waivers tailored towards individuals. Anybody who is on one of those waivers is meeting an institutional level of care. The other large waiver that we'll spend some time talking about today is our 1115 behavioral health waiver. As a reminder, 1115 waivers are demonstration waivers from the federal government. So that's tailored towards the whole system. It allows us to make wholesale changes. And for Alaska, this brought in a whole new service array in behavioral health that allowed us to bill things under Medicaid that weren't previously billable. And I'll go into a few more details over the next couple of slides. When we think about Medicaid in Alaska, and like Dr. Zink said, the reason we're honing in on Medicaid is because the Department of Justice report focused on Medicaid. In particular, those services covered through behavioral health, and that is why our response is tailored to Medicaid. Alaska is a fee-for-service state, That means a provider delivers a service and we pay for it. And that can be that they're billing for each service. So therapies, services coming along a person or a lab, a test, treatment, and so on. There is currently no managed care in Alaska. An important reminder, outside of the Alaska Psychiatric Institute, the state is not providing these services directly to individuals. We make the service available to be reimbursed, and we rely on private providers, including tribal health organizations, to enroll in Medicaid and deliver these services. And I just want to take a second to acknowledge that billing Medicaid is challenging, especially for new providers. But I think you would hear from providers that billing any healthcare payer is challenging. Moving on to slide 4, the Department of Justice highlighted Alaska's 1115 waiver as a key underpinning to address their concerns and expanding services for children. So given this importance, I'm going to spend just a few minutes on this slide. So just bear with me as this slide gets into a little bit more detail. The department has provided extensive updates on the 1115 over the years since Senate Bill 74 in 2016 was passed. And that was the bill that directed the department to apply for a waiver. The waiver was recognition of the need to stop relying just on grants and to stand up a suite of new services available by supporting more community-based services and expanding substance use disorder services. The full suite of these services were not available until regulations for the mental health side of the waiver went live through emergency regulations in May of 2020. This timing was 2 months into the COVID-19 pandemic and during the same time as the DOJ investigation. As you know, all healthcare providers had to quickly pivot and basically completely change the way they delivered care. It would make sense that providers during this time would be slower to turn on these new services under the 1115. The goal of the waiver was emphasis on early stage prevention and intervention to avoid higher cost services such as institutionalization. As a reminder, like I mentioned on the earlier slide, the 1115 waiver brought in new behavioral health services that previously were not billable under Medicaid. One important area the waiver included was expanding these Medicaid-covered services to individuals who are at risk of developing a mental health or substance use disorder. And this was a profound change that's important to note. Prior to including this in the waiver, someone had to meet the definition and have a diagnosis of a serious mental illness as an adult or a severe emotional disturbance for children in order to receive services. And outside of our waiver, at-risk is not an allowable criteria for Medicaid services. The Department of Health has received extensive feedback from providers on how we can improve our waiver, including how we can reduce administrative burden. We currently have out a regulation package that is our attempt to take this feedback we've received and improve our waiver. And this is separate. This is a state regulation package that is separate from our waiver extension application we have in with the federal government. And finally, I'd like to highlight that the state has not seen the full benefit yet of our waiver. However, we are confident that these benefits will continue to unfold and we will see an increased uptick in providers offering these services.
So we've talked a little bit about, for the record, Ann Zink, Chief Medical Officer. We've talked a little bit about the structures and the underpinning of behavioral health services and some of the mechanisms underneath the 1115. And there's three major focus areas that we're looking at and going forward on what ways to improve the mental health care within the state. This includes Medicaid reimbursement, structure, and participation, expanding methods for service and delivery type, as well as facility type, and then expanding and establishing crisis stabilization care, so really being able to move upstream and move preventative. We know that health and healthcare is more than just being able to get timely and appropriate care, but it needs to be close to home, especially for children who their life and their livelihood is very much connected to their community and their family. Alaska's always been challenged in getting the care that they need close to home. When I moved up here, ANMC was the only trauma center in the state. Slowly that's changed. We now have 14 trauma hospitals with trauma designation working on a care collaboration across the state. And we need to do the same thing for behavioral health care. We need to make sure that there's a continuum of care that people can access, timely and appropriate care, no matter where they are in the state. Having Medicaid pay for needed behavioral health services and a rate that providers will accept is going to be critical to being able to move forward to that. We're going to go through each of these, including expanding service delivery type and the crisis stabilization, in the next following slides.
For the record, Heather Carpenter. And on slide six, I wanted to spend a minute on rates. We know rates are an important tool in the toolbox for the department when it comes to incentivizing services. We know rates alone do not ensure providers will deliver these services. However, I want to acknowledge that over this last year, the department has increased rates or is in the stages of finalizing increased rates in the four areas you see on the screen. So this is for the 1115, for rates for home and community-based services, and the one that is in progress is the rebasing for community behavioral health providers. And moving on to slide seven, we know that reform and improvement is ongoing. It's never something the department just thinks is a job we finished. We're always looking at how we can expand methods of service delivery and increase facility types. When we think about increasing the utilization of existing services, one big thing we're talking about, especially in this context, is how do we increase the uptick of providers offering these 1115 services? That regulation package you heard me mention is one way we hope to reduce administrative burdens and incentivize more providers to do this work. We are also fully implementing HB 265, which was passed last year as the bill to increase and expand telehealth services. I want to highlight this for a minute because this is tied to a couple of different efforts. One, telehealth was an important tool that the Department of Justice has told us we should look at for increasing these services across the state. And I also want to highlight, while not a Medicaid effort, we did have the governor's broadband task force. And I know we mentioned this the last hearing, but in order to increase our delivery of telehealth, we have to ensure that individuals across the state have access to high enough broadband and where they can actually do, you know, if it's a video feed or whatever. So we really need to think about those tools and how we can increase that. And I just want to acknowledge that that is not something the Department of Health can do alone. As many of you know, that takes a lot of different moving parts. And finally, the department is identifying gaps and improving the continuum of care. House Bill 172 last year, which stood up two parts of the Crisis Now framework, was a tool we put in place to ensure our statutes aligned with the services in the 1115 waiver. And we have other areas we're strategically looking at as well. It's important to remember when we think about the continuum and we're trying to stand up a full continuum for these children, we have to think about the continuum they're going to access when they turn adults and age out of youth services. So the department is fully strategically thinking about those adult services as well as youth services. And I will turn it back over to Dr. Zink.
For the record, Ann Zink, we will be talking more about provider engagement a little bit later, as well as workforce, because those are incredibly critical. One thing I want to highlight still on this slide before I move on to the next one, you mentioned broadband, but also every time that we're thinking about infrastructure dollars, also thinking about healthcare workforce dollars. We oftentimes think here of, you know, housing is limited in a community. And so what way can we make sure that we're using every lever that we can to make sure that there is housing, that there is broadband, that there is telehealth services across our state, so that we can be able to move the Medicaid and other waivers to be able to move forward, but it's going to take all of these different parts. I would like to now highlight a little bit more about crisis stabilization services and their need to reduce higher level of care. Many of you have heard many presentations on this kind of Crisis Now stabilization that the Mental Health Trust has been leading for some time. And there's been some real successes. I kind of think of them as seeds of change that are coming into fruition that need growth and nurturing and watering to fully get off the ground. So with the national effort to increase the statewide crisis call line, the 988, now Alaskans via text or phone can access 24-hour crisis call center help and support, and continue to encourage Alaskans to access that. Regarding our mobile crisis teams, we've started to see these come up in Alaska, and I would like to highlight Fairbanks' work. They have now been able to start a mobile crisis response team. So if you call 911 or 988 and have a mental health emergency, instead of law enforcement or EMS showing up your door, mental health clinicians in regular clothes can meet you in person, and that is the ultimate, being able to derive a direct care close to home. What they were able to see is a 70% reduction in emergency department visits by these mobile integrated teams. So how can we take the lessons learned in Fairbanks and be able to extend that across the state? And then 23-hour stabilization and short-term stabilization. This is something that we continue to hear across the state. Sending someone even to Anchorage can be a really big challenge from their home, their community, their loved ones, and their life, and being able to stabilize as much as possible in community. We're grateful for Fairbanks, for Bartlett, for ANMC, and for Providence, all currently working on standing up 23-hour short-term stabilization centers. and also working with many of our rural communities to say, what would this look like in your community? How can this be set up with your hospital or separately? And what can we do to support that? So we're seeing some significant progress now that we have legislation that allows this to be a license type moving forward.
For the record, Heather Carpenter. So I am currently on slide 9. And before the effort of the Bring the Kids Home initiative, the out-of-state placements for children reached a high of 965 in 2004. I highlight this to show the efforts that the departments, then as Department of Health and Social Services, the trust, local providers, and advocates all took together to turn that tide. And this was just shy of 20 years ago. In 2004, I was a senior in high school, so we're not even talking about a full generation ago. In comparison today, there are 73 children out of state, and that is out of 2,995 children receiving behavioral health care so far just in this calendar year. And those are children who are covered by Medicaid. As a reminder, we have no line of sight on children covered by private insurance where their parents may admit them to an out-of-state facility. And since the Department of Justice started its investigation in 2020, the state has further reduced our out-of-state placement by about 25%.
For the record, Ann Zink, we've been talking a lot about systems, but at the end of the day, these are people and people who need care today. It's important to remember that their lives and the structure of the systems don't always meet the needs of the patients, and the Department of Justice report does have many heartbreaking stories of children wanting to be closer to home, having the needs that they need in their community. But these children are placed where we're able to get care. I would like to highlight this is not just a challenge in the state of Alaska, but unfortunately this is such a huge challenge across the nation. And as I spend time working with other people in my position across the country, we are all struggling with this. So what can we do today? What can we do tomorrow? And how can we look forward? So about a year ago, we started this Improving Complex Care Coordination project within the Department of Health, as well as the Department of Family and Community Health Services, to make sure our departments are well-aligned and meet individual patient needs right now. In this is the Crisis Response Team. This is kind of like a multidisciplinary team that meets weekly to be able to address patient needs that are happening today. So just to highlight this week's cases, we reviewed 3 cases. One had a multitude of behavioral health clinicians, both in-state and out-of-state, that were needing to help care for the patient with no unified plan of what the child needed and no identifiable place within the country that would meet her needs. So the plan was to get those clinicians on the same page to discuss what does this patient really need and how can we piece systems together to support it. The second was a patient who is in an inpatient psychiatric facility, needs to be discharged, but is going to require 3-on-1 services, meaning 3 providers for that one patient. There's no acuity level that allows us to pay for a 3-for-1 service need. So we had to braid together numerous funding types to be able to figure out how to provide a 3-on-1 service type so this patient could move back into community out of a psychiatric facility and being able to find things to make that payment work. And the third was an individual who, again, had a series of payment structures where there was no payment mechanism that included room and board, behavioral health needs, and the outpatient care center that this patient needed, again, with trying to find ways to braid together systems. So the crisis response team is these individual case-level conversations about what we can do to meet patients' needs today. Out of that then influences this what we call the triple C, so the complex care committee. And this is a state of Alaska committee where we're looking at what ways do we need to change the system to improve the system. So if we're regularly getting patients who need a 2-for-1 or a 3-for-1, do we need to change the regulations? Do we need to change other payment systems? What continues to come up so that we can make data-driven and informed decisions about regulations, about statute, about license type to be able to move forward? And then the third major component of this is the Complex Care Advisory Group. And that's working with the state of Alaska as well as our multitude of partners to say, okay, this facility type or this service type is needed, how can we be able to partner together, just like you've seen with the 23-hour stabilizations? So the hope is that this is not a one set of solutions, but this builds the mechanisms, kind of the cogwheels, to be able to take the information of what individuals need, find real-time solutions for them, have that inform the state's work, and partner with external stakeholders so that we're constantly reiterating and building and improving and changing our services to meet the needs of Alaska. As Alaska grows, as Medicaid changes, as private insurance and public insurers change, so that we're able to constantly be able to iterate. This doesn't take over the other important work that's happening, like the Complex Care Collaborative, the additional positions that have been added at DFCS or the multi-sector state coordination group. There's a lot of care coordination that's happening in silos, but how can we make sure that we're learning from this in real time and being able to influence and improve the system as we move forward?
For the record, Heather Carpenter. So we are on slide 11 about tribal collaboration. And I just want to highlight that tribal collaboration is a part of the foundation of how we do work at the Department of Health and the Department of Family and Community Services. For much of rural Alaska, our tribal providers are the only Medicaid-enrolled provider. Not to mention, they may be the only provider for any payer. So moving forward, our tribal partners are going to be a key part of how we fully identify and implement solutions to address this problem and how we're keeping kids closer to home. We cannot do that without our tribal partners.
Moving on to slide 12, Alaskans need and want solutions today, but there are many seeds of change that have been planted that need support and growth and nurturing to make these changes possible for today, tomorrow, and the future. And I want to highlight some critical work in the near term that has started that are really the building blocks of moving forward that we'll continue to need to support. The first is on workforce. In the FY24 budget, we saw a position for coordinating health workforce development, utilizing Family Service Training Center partnership, developing standardized modules online, and leveraging community health workers. Just an hour prior to this presentation, I was part of a conversation with psychiatrists and emergency department physicians from around the state, rolling out the SMART form to standardize medical clearance prior to going in. So what ways we can support patients into that workforce. The second one is, again, along those lines of provider support. We were fortunate to work with the Mental Health Trust as well as the Hospital Association to bring over 20 providers from around this state, from rural as well as urban areas, psychiatrists in urban areas who've never met each other, all to the National Update on Behavioral Health Emergencies Conference to help increase their education and collaboration and answer real-time questions about what is an MC-100, what are the regulations, how can we support you as clinicians? And we began a webinar series to address the topics of need for Alaskans. The Hospital Association is helping to support. That was the webinar that just was today from 12 until 1. Increasing behavioral health infrastructure, so the regulations for telehealth, which are currently posted and open for public comment. Regulations to define two near licensing type for crisis stabilization and crisis residential centers, which are currently in the deliberative process before going out for public comment, and we expect to be posted soon. Technical assistance and work groups for behavioral health crisis centers, which are happening now. We'd also like to highlight that DFCS has two regulations that have recently gone into effect to also assist with placing kids in the least restrictive setting as possible, including one that has difficult care augmented rate went into effect on February 22nd and allows a third rate for payment for more complex patients, as well as an intensive augmented rate that went into effect April 9th for children with known complex needs who are either on a waiver or a wait list for a waiver, including children who are not in waiver service but are at risk for hospitalization without stabilization. The next big category was increased utilization of waivers. So as mentioned, the extension of the 1115, which we talked about before, regulation package to tailor the waivers needed to meet the Alaskans' needs, and plan to eradicate the intellectual and developmental disability IDD wait list submitted to the legislature in December 2022. And then lastly, developing infrastructure for the complex care, which I touched on briefly, including building up the crisis response team. DFCS has hired a full-time position who started in February to help to coordinate the space, the complex care committee meetings, as well as the advisory groups, as mentioned previously. So for what's next, I want to highlight that we are Alaska, we are Alaskans, and we, as all of Alaskans, will be needed to find solutions. Providers, patients, policymakers, and the public will all play a critical role in providing behavioral health care in Alaska that will meet the needs of children as well as adults. The next major step in this effort is forming a statewide level steering committee that will involve regional stakeholder groups meeting throughout the summer to be able to get additional input and information that we will then share publicly and bring out to the legislature next year with additional input and feedback for what can be done to continue to improve the crisis standards of care and improve behavioral health care across Alaska. Alaska remains committed to the continuity of care and collaboration of stakeholders to serve more Alaska youth in community and appreciate the committee's time for this conversation.
Thank you very much. Questions? Senator Giesel, are you ready for questions? You were ready earlier. So.
Yeah, I've been making notes here. So I just go back to slide 2. What percent of the behavioral health funding does come from Medicaid? Do you have a sense of that? I mean, are we 50% of the funding? I suppose the other payers are something you don't know.
For the record, Heather Carpenter, through the chair, Senator Giesel, I would have to work with the other payers to get an idea, and it's hard to get that full understanding since we don't have, as you know, an all-payer claims database to really track something like this. We can try to find out. I do know Medicaid is covering, you know, over a third of Alaskans, and I think we cover a larger portion of children. So we can try to get you some statistics on what that equates to.
Sure, sure, because certainly not every beneficiary is getting behavioral health.
Right.
Yes, sure. Let's see. I had another question in here. Here it is. So you've had challenges with your computer data systems. Is that an impediment here to behavioral health services? Was that part of the problem that the feds identified?
Through the chair, Senator Giesel, are you talking about our eligibility system? Are you talking about our...
The payment system that audits every year, gets audited every year.
So in terms of the behavioral health system, we have acknowledged very publicly our challenges with Optum as our vendor. The feds did not identify, you know, that Optum was part of the problem of covering these services. It was really about the availability of were their providers to deliver these services in community. I do have Director Farina Brown online. We do practically know that when providers are not getting paid, it stresses them, and then they, you know, we've had some providers seriously on the brink of having to make really difficult decisions about their service delivery. So I think when we're looking, you know, holistically, we know the payment structure is important, and paying claims timely and accurately is just a critical foundation piece we are trying to get back to. And again, I know we haven't talked about it. We haven't talked about it in this committee, but the department is taking every step we can within that contractual process to hold Optum accountable. And I'll stop there in case you have a follow-up.
You know, when I think about those audits, the errors that the department makes in submitting claims to the federal government and the repayments that that are identified in the audits are really concerning. So that's why I asked if the data system was a problem still.
Yeah, and for the record, this is Ann Zink. As mentioned, Farina can talk more about Optum, and I think that it's incredibly important that we have as transparent and as reliable data sources. I would just add there's two other kind of data sources that I think about in a sense. One is AK Ames, kind of a system used by behavioral health providers. It's currently through the process of going out through an RFP and kind of being looked at how we can improve that system to reduce the workload burden on a lot of healthcare providers, which we hear a lot about in that space. And then I would also just, you know, really thank the legislature for the work for the HIE, for the Health Information Exchange, and the additional funding that went out from an RFI to an RFP, got granted, is currently in the process of hiring executive director. But out of that, we're already starting to get more system-wide data to understand when patients are bouncing between the systems, where they're kind of falling out, so that we have better visibility. So while it's not a claims base, I think that we are making strides, but there is a long way to go. Honestly, all of almost every job and every industry now, data is a huge part of what is done. And to make data-informed decisions is really important to make sure that we have these systems in place, and why you saw requests for IT positions within the state, and why you've heard a lot about other IT challenges that we've had, because we really need to make sure these data systems work. But if you don't mind, Director Brown, is there anything else that you would add?
Ms. Brown, and if you'd identify yourself for the record, too.
Thank you. For the record, Acting Director Farina Brown. I just want to confirm, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Senator Giesel, in response to your question, the DOJ findings did identify the Administrative Services Organization as an area for better administration and, better oversight of administration of claims adjudication. What we have and continue to work through with Optum are ongoing issues with claims adjudication that do result in reprocessing projects where providers will have payments that have been paid, recouped, and then repaid. As both Heather Carpenter and Ann Zink have identified, we are consistently working with Optum and working through all of our contractual levers. We are currently in a corrective action with Optum regarding the ongoing claims adjudication issues. We fully are aware and we acknowledge that the claims payment have contributed to the difficulty with providers standing up services across the state, because if you don't have a consistent payment mechanism, then you don't have the ability to grow. So I, for full transparency, we recognize that it is a critical element in how we see the waiver being successful. And without remediation, you know, we are going to continue to experience slow growth.
Thank you. Thank you. One other question.
Sure. Senator Giesel, go ahead.
Okay. And I'm looking at slide 8. So this has to do with crisis stabilization services. And of course, I'm looking at bullet number 3, 23-hour and short-term stabilization. My concern there is it's great. I mean, I'm a big supporter, big fan of crisis stabilization and its services, and I know the successes in Fairbanks. I'm wondering what the back door looks like. After the 23 hours and 59 minutes, what happens?
Heather Carpenter, for the record.
We would just note that crisis stabilization was legislation sponsored by Senator Giesel.
Yes, you both had a lot to do with both bills getting through in 2020 and, of course, last year. So thinking about the back door, when you go into a 23-hour center, if you are stabilized, then it's getting you back. Or if you don't, well, let me pause. Let me think about how this would look if you might be on an involuntary commitment track. So you're going through a 23-hour, you know, crisis stabilization center. If you are not stabilized and still meet criteria for that involuntary hold, you would be transferred to a short-term crisis residential center. When we're thinking about centers such as Providence and Bartlett, and for those of us that have toured the RI International facilities down in Arizona, they're just connected. So it's just through a door and you get to go to that next level of care. It is really important to think and understand that if we don't have the community services to wrap around these, we're just putting in a new choke point in the system. So right now we have individuals who might get stuck in emergency rooms while they're waiting to go to a DET, so a designated evaluation and treatment bed. And unless we have the full continuum, robust continuum like we've talked about, we're just going to move that point to people getting stuck. So that is something the department, the trust, we're constantly looking at, and why you hear us talk about ensuring that each region of the state has a full continuum. So we're ensuring that Alaskans are getting this care as close to home as possible. And our hope is we get individuals stabilized quickly, they get discharged, connected back to their community providers, and then they're back home, back in their jobs, all of those normal things.
Sure. And the residential treatment, of course, is important. I also think about the partial hospitalization that is being stood up in some areas as well. But the back door is important. Otherwise, right back calling 988. Thank you.
Senator Giesel, through the chair, if I may, you know, we have seen an increase in DET facilities. So, you know, Matsu has stood up. We've been having conversations with Fairbanks, who's been looking at standing up children's services and what that would look like. So I think, as you mentioned, that back door is incredibly important. National data shows that 23-hour stabilization will stabilize about 70% of patients. So definitely not everything. But it's a lot of transfer and a lot of movement and moving people away. So if we can stabilize in community through that crisis, that is going to still really reduce the number of inpatient to make sure that those are available. And then in many of our rural communities, also thinking about what ways those 23-hour stabilization places could also be a potential where patients could come back to. So say they may have been at API or they were at North Star and maybe not ready to go fully back into the community. So I think that's been one of the challenges, is what way we can think about not just a unidirectional or a backdoor, but then as people are improving, what way we can support them along the continuum of care all the way back to home as well, rather than having this kind of cliff which they have to fall off, which can make it really hard to get that well within an inpatient psychiatric facility rather than being able to transition back home. So a lot of conversation about that as well.
Sure, which is Mr. Chairman, really kind of what the partial hospitalization is intended to do. It's a sort of like a day, a program where there's intense therapy, but the person goes home for the night. So there's still that family connection. Obviously, probably limited in rural Alaska. But thank you, Mr. Chairman, for those questions.
Senator Kaufman, Senator Tobin. He's passing.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple questions, and I do really appreciate you coming back and providing this information. It's really helpful. I will say that, again, just looking at the DOD report and knowing that they did site visits in 2022, knowing that some of their data points are coming from 2019 and 2022, on slide four where you talk about how the 1115 waiver was propped up in the height of the pandemic, I'm just not really confident with the response of, oh, well, this was before current data points, which are provided in the report. So they're just a little bit inconsistency there. So thinking about that, I want to really go back to the line where on slide four you say emphasize early stage outreach, prevention, and intervention. I think that the hope is that folks don't go into crisis services. They don't need to that level of support. And so I'm curious because the slide deck didn't really cover that piece. In the report, the DOJ report, they talk about school-based services. They talk about those early interventions happening in community, in homes. I understand Alaska is big. I get it. It's not a new challenge, though. Our state has been big since Time Emporium. So it's one that I don't necessarily want to continue to harp on, this idea that we have difficulty providing services. We will always have difficulty providing services. So I'm curious about how you might overcome those challenges. What are the work you've been doing to really prop up providers in schools, and what are some of the preventative options that are available? And I'm going to ask for that component that is identified on page 22 of the DOJ report, which talks about the cultural component. So not just relying on our tribal partners to carry all that weight, what are we doing as well to ensure that that is a key part of all the work that we're doing?
Through the chair, Senator Tobin, and for the record, Heather Carpenter, I do want to just acknowledge I didn't highlight this specifically on our tribal collaboration page, but the department, both departments, so Department of Health and Department of Family and Community Services, have designated tribal liaisons in the commissioner's offices. I hold that title for the Department of Health. Each division in each department has designated tribal liaisons. Delivering and thinking about culturally relevant care is just incredibly important. And like I said, that tribal collaboration is just part of the foundation. And I think it is important to acknowledge that, again, I mean, these tribal providers are often the only providers at all in these rural communities when we're thinking about some of the just heartbreaking cases the DOJ report highlighted. So they're not going to be the only providers we're going to work with. But when Dr. Zink talked about the approach of a steering committee and holding regional work groups, again, as I mentioned, the state outside of API is not a direct service provider. So we have to really understand from these providers, what do we need to do? We acknowledge these are going to be some hard conversations. And it may be, what do we have to change to ensure that services can be offered in the schools? I think I mentioned a little bit last hearing that delivering services in schools through Medicaid is not as simple as it sounds. We've had audit findings in the past and had to pay back a lot of money to the feds. So how we set that up with rules, and CMS has rules about services and how those are delivered in schools. We had a consultant look at this. Rich Albertoni from Public Consulting Group, it was part of his report that we finalized last year. Actually, I think it finalized in the fall of 2021. So we have a lot of work to do there. We have probably more work than we can all do at the same time, which is why collectively we need to think about this and have a structure of what should come first, second, third. The good news is we still have a lot of flexibility and options through Senate Bill 74. We still may have to think about if we have to go back to the federal government and ask more permission to do things, whether that's through our state plan, whether that's through a waiver amendment to the 1115. We've talked about, you know, how do we stand up some new care there. So I think we have incredibly intelligent and compassionate people in Alaska. I know we can solve this, but it is going to take things thinking about when we're making sure we have services in these communities. How do we have the providers? How do we get them licensed quickly? You know, how do we make sure, like Dr. Zink mentioned, that we have adequate housing for them to live in? So that is why it's also important for us to think about who else do we need to bring along to the table outside of the Department of Health and the Department of Family and Community Services to help us solve this. Well, I know enough about the waiver. I will say if you want some specifics on the preventative services, I would like to defer to Acting Director Brown to talk about that.
Follow up, or did you want?
I'd love to hear from Director Brown, and I do have one follow-up question.
Ms. Brown, if you want to, or Acting Director Brown, if you want to respond to that or add additional information on that topic, and then we'll get to the follow-up question.
Sure, and thank you. For the record, Farina Brown, Acting Director, Division of Behavioral Health. What we've done when we think about the prevention, early intervention, and early components of care aspect for the waiver, we really hone in on the use of the at-risk criteria. Because again, once an individual, an adult or a child, has to reach the threshold of severely mentally ill or severely emotionally disturbed, then you have escalated in whatever the behavioral health or symptomatic conditions that you're experiencing. And they've typically at that point cascaded into all types of functional impairments. So for us, that was one of the most essential aspects to ensure that individuals could engage in waiver services, providers could be paid before an adult or youth reached that threshold of SMI or SED. In addition to that, we've added a service specifically called home-based family treatment. Home-based family treatment allows for a family to engage in services based on a social determinant of health that's crosswalked to what we call a Z code, which is a diagnostic code that allows a provider to bill for services. It is essential in that early engagement for early intervention. And again, what we're trying to do is ensure that we're catching individuals upstream before symptoms cascade. The other critical piece of this, and this is not identified in the waiver, but it's school-based services. Many of our behavioral health providers, a huge part of their business revenue is school-based services. What we have done over the years, and this is probably not the best in being able to capture this, is that school-based services are often billed on an outpatient fee-for-service continuum. So what that means is I might have a clinician that's providing services in the school, but they are billing an outpatient code. So I can't look at just Medicaid claims data, mine that data, and say we are spending $32 million in school-based services. We know based on our engagement with providers and many of the grants that we provide that they are engaging and leveraging clinicians in schools, behavioral health, clinical associates, paraprofessionals. But it is the current mechanism and the way that it is billed for that doesn't allow us to provide concretely what that overall dollar amount is. But I would be remiss if I did not identify that it is a huge component of what many of our behavioral health providers do across the state. You did have a question about culturally relevant. We have for many years in all of our grant requirements, we include the requirement that all services must be culturally relevant. Through the waiver, we included in our qualified addiction professional requirement a cultural component as a continuing education requirement in order to meet that criteria as a qualified addiction professional, which is a requirement in order for a behavioral health professional to bill 1115 SUD services. We've also added for all of our crisis services, they have to meet the SAMHSA guidelines, which include being culturally relevant and influenced. So we are, as best as possible, ensuring that we've codified through regulation and just through our general engagement and practice with all of our behavioral health providers, how critical it is to ensure services are culturally relevant.
Further questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I do appreciate that. I spend a lot of my time reading quite a few pieces of literature from elders, which talks about how to really help young people, we need to make sure that all components of their psyche are being served, including their spirit and their language and their foods. And so those are all pieces that need to be a part of this conversation. My follow-up question, and this is just a request for data, which is on slide number 15, I believe, you indicate that there are 73, excuse me, I might have the slide actually wrong, it might be 8. Oh, shoot, it is a slide.
Nine,
thank you. You indicate there are 73 children who are currently out of state that are receiving services through Medicaid. I'm just curious to know that number since 2019, to know how many, what that number has been. It's helpful to have those data points. Additionally, I know in the DOJ report, it indicated that Northstar alone referred 150 kids out of state. So if there's additional data points that isn't captured in that, I'd love to see that if we have the ability to request that information from Northstar and other providers of that nature. I agree, it's not 400. It's not above 400 or north of 400, as we saw with the Bring the Children Home. 73 still seems like a lot to me.
Through the chair.
And just before you enter, for the data request, if it's available, I'd actually supplement that by go back to 2014, just because 2019 is kind of on the cusp of the pandemic, and if we're going to see some meaningful trends, it'd be nice to go earlier. But then please continue with your answer.
For the record, Heather Carpenter and Chair Klayman and Senator Tobin, we can work on some data points. It may take a little bit of back and forth with you to make sure we get the right ones. I just want to highlight it actually at the height before the Bring the Kids Home initiative. It wasn't 400 kids out of state. It was 965 in 2004. So while we still acknowledge 73 seems like a lot, it's important to reflect on the amount of work the department has put in the last 20 years to reduce that number.
And if I may, sure. Senator Klayman, Anne Zink for the record, Senator Tobin through the chair. A couple of things that on your last question that I just wanted to highlight, happy to send to you. There is a really great slide deck that shows the services that are provided by the 1115 waiver, traditional Medicaid, and grant, and it goes through them line by line and colored. We thought about putting them in the slide, but they're just very detailed, and so we'll be happy to send that to you. A couple of things I would offer to you is there's a new Office of School Health and Safety that is meeting with the schools regularly. And so what a small school district needs versus a big school district is going to be very different. And so there's a lot of nuance to that we're working with. And we also have an Office of Health Equity and Healthy and Equitable Communities. And a lot of their work is also thinking about that space. And it was part of the reason why we broke down the response to regional, because what one region needs is going to be very different than another region, and wanted to really recognize what the cultural needs in one region are going to be very different. And that's the reason for not having a whole state response, but this regional response that we pull together. Thank you.
And recognize that Senator Keel just joined us, and I apologize when Senator Tobin joined us. I didn't note that, but I bet the record did catch it. I just have a couple of questions, and then we're going to go to our next presenter. The first, in looking through the overview, which I think is the April 2023, which is the official response to the Department of Justice letter, one of the things that struck me was that over the years, Alaska has made a decision to largely contract out pretty much every feature of this coverage, not only just the services provided, with the exception of the Alaska Psychiatric Institute. When you go to other states, they have state psychiatric hospitals, they have state-managed homes for children that are behavioral health related, and we've made a decision over many years, and I'm not saying it's good, bad, or indifferent, but we've made a decision over many years to contract out basically all of these services. And so because we've contracted that out to try to increase availability of services, absent a massive step on the state to bring more in-house, we have to get outside entities to provide the very services. And I think that's one of the structures that's one of the realities that we have. But in connection with that, Medicare rates versus Medicaid rates. I know there's a lot of criticism about Medicare rates and how low they are. Or do we have the same issues about even getting providers for Medicaid that we have with getting providers for Medicare?
Again, for the record, Heather Carpenter, I'll start with this and then, of course, let Dr. Zink share her clinician perspective. So rates are a whole art into itself, and it is we do acknowledge, and we thank Senator Giesel for her work on highlighting the issue with low Medicare rates. In this state, when you're thinking about professional services, Medicaid does pay higher than Medicare. So that's often why you hear people say, hey, Medicaid pays higher in Alaska than Medicare. The other piece you have to think about is that with a whole host of services we do, they are subject to CMS upper payment limits. So that could be different, you know, hospital services, nursing homes, dialysis. We're actually facing this and what we're thinking about with rebasing with community behavioral health providers. So what that means is when somebody is facing an upper payment limit, we have to prove to CMS that we're not actually paying above Medicare. So that is why we have to think about how that goes into play. So upper payment limits are a whole nuanced thing, and if it's something, you know, you're interested in, we can provide some more information. But I just think most individuals in Alaska who are kind of casually watching healthcare do not understand that nuance, and that we actually do have to pay lower than Medicare in a lot of areas.
Okay. And then anything to add, Dr. Sink?
For the record, Ann Sink, we see children all the time who can't access outpatient Medicaid services. And I would just highlight that rates are important, payment is important, but there's also a lot of other things that go into providing services within a state. And that's part of the reason why we've put this effort into supporting providers, to giving them resources, to being able to connect them to specialty services. And then there's just a nature of scalability. So if you're going to become, you know, a pediatric eating disorder specialist, having enough kids that you can serve regularly and having the payment systems between the private insurance and Medicaid align enough that you can provide similar care in your day-to-day regardless of the payer type become an issue. And so that volume status makes a big difference in Alaska when we're trying to encourage providers to open up a specific service type. So between PALPAC and between other services that we do from the back end, what ways can we support providers so that they can call a specialist with a specific code, so that family med doc who accepts Medicaid can help to support, and we can kind of raise up their ability to help support behavioral health services for that pediatrician, that family medicine practitioner in that community, as well as providing additional behavioral health services, psychiatrists and others. So I think it's a matter of both, not either or, and Medicaid is a part of it for payment, but there's more to that.
So then last question, then we'll switch to the next presenter. When I look through the official response from the department, there's a lot of services that I would describe as the full adults and children, but not lots of specific places where they're children specific to the services that are provided. And is there going to be an effort in coming up with the plans that are coming out and not here yet, but coming soon, in which there's going to be more specific focus on children, or is the plans that are being worked on primarily kind of for the whole continuum, but not specific to children?
Yeah, for the record, our vision for the summer and the regional cares is really to address this report. So it's children and behavioral health services. Our hope, though, is that we build upon that, because children become adults, and their physical health, their mental health, their social health, their cultural health are all a part of those things as well. And so we're talking with other regional work groups on how their work can help to support this effort as well. But that is the focus for our efforts for the summer.
Thank you. Yeah, I would note that it's easy when you have children and adults that the children can get lost in the larger numbers of adults. And that's always the worry.
Mr. Chairman, could I ask one other question?
Last question.
Okay. This pertains to children.
Yes.
I wanted to ask Director Brown, and I could have missed this, but you were talking, Senator Tobin was asking about school-based care. And you said it was difficult to parse out who was getting care in a school-based services venue. Do you have a special code for that? How can we help you do that as someone that does school-based care?
Through the chair, for the record, Acting Director, Division of Behavioral Health, Senator Diesel, thank you for the question. We do have, and I apologize for not being clear, we do have a suite of services called school-based services, and it is a very distinct set of services, but it does not represent the full continuum of behavioral health services that are being provided in school. If a provider utilizes what is called a place of service code that identifies school, then we are able to mine Medicaid data for that place of service, and we can give a dollar amount associated with the expenditures that are being provided. However, not all of our behavioral health providers utilize the place of service school. They might use another place of service school called 99, which is other appropriate community setting. And so that's something that we have talked about as the school-based services conversation has grown over the last year, and really encouraging and educating providers to ensure they are appropriately coding. So in short, yes, we can provide that, but it would not be reflective that it is exclusive of all services that are being provided in school, simply because there's the nuance between using place of service school and place of service 99. And I apologize for that being slightly technical, but.
Thank you for that, Director Brown, and just rabbit trail, Mr. Chairman, underscoring the importance of school period and school funding, so that these venues are available for children to receive these kinds of services. Thank you.
Couldn't agree more. So next we're going to hear from Jen Griffiths. She is here in Juneau, lives in Anchorage, came down today for this committee to provide her perspective as a parent of a child who is very much in this system. Welcome, Ms. Griffiths, if you want to identify yourself for the record, She's got some slides, and you can proceed.
Good afternoon. My name is Jen Griffiths. I live in Anchorage, and I'm representing myself today. Thank you, Chair Clayman and committee members, for the opportunity to testify. I am a system consultant and a policy professional. I've worked in public policy in both Alaska and Idaho. I've presented at national conferences and co-authored academic articles on topics related to children's behavioral health systems and systems of care. I'm currently pursuing my Doctor of Law in Policy degree through Northeastern University with a research focus on the inclusion of parents in the design, implementation, and evaluation of federally funded state-level child-serving systems, including children's behavioral health systems. But most importantly, I'm a parent of a child who spent years in out-of-state residential treatment settings due to the lack of community behavioral health services. Our story didn't take place in Alaska. It took place in Idaho. But I know from my work with parents across the country that stories like mine and stories like those shared by other Alaskan parents echo in communities and states across the country, from Arizona to Virginia and everywhere in between. Today, I'm going to share our story. We moved to a small community in rural Idaho in 2010, shortly after adopting two young girls from the foster care system in Texas. We also had three boys, everyone under the age of 8, so life was full. A couple of years after moving to Idaho, our middle daughter began to struggle with some intense behavioral issues. She'd always been strong-willed and intense, but we had experienced parenting those type of behaviors. So for a while, we survived. Despite our best efforts, her behaviors continued to escalate, and by the time she was 6, those behaviors began to eclipse our parenting abilities. We knew we needed help, but help was nowhere to be found. My husband was a physician. I was an educator. We knew systems. We knew how to research. We had money and privilege, and we couldn't find anything. Everywhere we turned was a closed door. She had the wrong diagnosis. She was too young. Her behaviors were too intense. Her behaviors weren't intense enough. Providers were too far away, or the wait lists were too long. Door after door closed, and we were starting to panic. She was continuing to escalate, and we weren't sure we could keep everyone safe. After months with no answers, we decided inpatient hospitalization was our only option. We drove 3.5 hours away to the nearest pediatric psychiatric hospital and left our 6-year-old with strangers. That hospitalization in early December 2012 was quickly followed by 2 more over the next 6 weeks. I know we celebrated Christmas that year because I have the pictures to prove it, but the details are a little blurry. Without access to community services, our treatment choices were limited. We tried piecing supports together and even attempted a therapeutic home setting in the largest urban area in the state. But intensive community services were lacking statewide, so moving her to another home did not provide her the therapeutic and behavioral support she needed. After multiple treatment failures, each of which created additional trauma for the entire family, we began pursuing residential treatment options, not because we wanted to, but because we had no other choice for helping her navigate these challenges. Following her placement in residential treatment, we worked with our Idaho case management team on multiple occasions to try and transition her back into the community, but we were never successful. Her intense level of needs did not match the available community services. And the lack of residential treatment options in Idaho meant that she grew up in residential treatment facilities in multiple states over several years. While our family was struggling to find services for our daughter, the state of Idaho was entering into another round of litigation in an attempt to settle a 30-year-old lawsuit related to lack of access to appropriate mental health treatment for children and youth with serious emotional disturbance. The intention of the parties was to reach a settlement agreement through a mediation process, and I was asked to be the parent representative on the plaintiff's mediation team. I participated in mediation meetings for over a year before we transitioned into the settlement agreement phase and then into planning the implementation of the new children's behavioral health system. I continued to support various aspects of the system implementation work for the next 8 years until we moved to Alaska in September of 2021. During the entire time I was supporting the system level work, our family was still actively navigating the same system, struggling to access the right level of services for our daughter. We were experiencing in real time the impacts of the very system I was advocating to change. There were a lot of system level accomplishments in those 8 years, but the ones that make me proudest are related to the work I did to infuse parent voice in every aspect of Idaho's children's behavioral health system. When I started, I was the only parent at the table, and including parent and youth voice was often an afterthought or a box that needed to be checked off. When I left, there were many parents at those tables, and their words and ideas and experiences were central to the planning, design, and evaluation of the system. Now that I've shared some of my personal story, I'd like to provide a little context around systems of care before ending with what I hope are some thoughtful recommendations to consider as the planning process moves forward. We hear the term system of care often these days in reference to the coordination of various types of services in various types of systems, including early childhood, primary care, and child welfare. While the concept is applicable to all of these systems, it has some unique aspects when it's used within the children's mental health context. The term system of care was first used by Stroll and Friedman in 1986 in response to the need for a systemic way to address the needs of children with behavioral health diagnoses who were not being effectively treated in communities. The original concept has been updated several times since 1986 and is widely used in various settings across the country. The handout I provided from the National Technical Assistance Center for Children's Mental Health gives some additional details on system of care, including this definition. A system of care is a spectrum of effective, community-based services and supports for children and youth with or at risk for mental health or other challenges and their families that is organized into a coordinated network, builds meaningful partnerships with families and youth, and addresses their cultural and linguistic needs in order to help them function better at home, in school, in the community, and throughout life. Within that definition, you heard the core values of system of care: family-driven and youth-guided, community-based, and culturally and linguistically competent. Additionally, there are 12 guiding principles for systems of care, including a broad base of services, individualized treatment, cross-system collaboration, continuous quality improvement, and several others. While the system of care concept was the result of a federal initiative intended to address the mental health needs of children and youth, the implementation of systems of care for behavioral health across the country has been unequal. Much of this is due to the nuances of the various federal funding streams that support behavioral health systems and the broad choices that states have regarding if and how they will implement various components of system of care. Another challenge facing system of care implementation is the limited access to community-based services, especially for specific populations. For example, two populations that are consistently identified across various state systems as lacking access to the appropriate level of services are children with higher levels of need and children who live in rural areas. The result of these implementation challenges across the country has been investigations and lawsuits related to the lack of community-based services and continued reliance on residential treatment. And while Alaska can now add its name to the list of states currently attempting to remedy some of these systemic challenges facing children's behavioral health systems, Alaska does have some unique strengths that it brings to the table. The first strength is that Alaska has Medicaid waivers already in progress. This puts the state a step ahead of many other states who have faced these types of system challenges. A second strength is the already established relationships with tribal partners and other stakeholders These relationships will help provide a foundation that Alaska can use to build out its system of care. And finally, the recent state-level legislation related to crisis intervention and telehealth are types of system changes that are necessary in order to create a fully functional system of care. In addition to internal strengths, Alaska has the opportunity to leverage the lessons learned from other states who have embarked on this type of system work. I've identified three of these lessons on this slide, and I selected these three recommendations because based on my experience, they're common pitfalls for even the most well-intentioned states. And when these are thoughtfully included in planning, they have a significant positive impact on system transformation. The first is that parents and youth should be equal partners at the treatment level and at the system level. Equal partnership at the system level means parents are not just presented with a system design plan and asked for comments. They are actively involved in writing the plan. It means parents aren't just surveyed about their needs and experiences, but they're involved in designing the survey tools and interpreting the results. It means including parent voice at the decision-making tables, not just in the advisory groups. The second is that Medicaid is a funding source, not a system design. As noted in the Department of Justice report, Medicaid is absolutely important for developing behavioral health services. However, designing a system by first identifying the services that are needed, and then connecting those services to funding sources creates a system that's person-centered, not funding-centered. Additionally, this person-centered design strategy allows for easier identification of potential gaps, which can be easily missed in a funding-centered design strategy. And the final point is that person-centered data tells stories and transforms systems. Data is powerful, but without centering the data on those that are being served, the stories it tells are incomplete at best and harmful at their worst. Leveraging data for continuous improvement at both the treatment level and the system level can and should be done, but it must be person-centered every step of the way. Stories like ours and those of other families across Alaska and across the country may be a small percentage of the overall number of children being treated in behavioral health settings. But their impact, the ripple effects of our stories, have far-reaching consequences. When the right level of care at the right time is unavailable, the ripple effects are often more costly treatment, secondary trauma, and risks of behavioral health challenges far into young adulthood. But when the right level of care is available at the right time, like what we were finally able to access for our daughter, the ripple effects can be success in education, positive relationships, and goals for the future. Parenting children with serious emotional disturbance and transforming children's mental health systems are both challenging and messy tasks. But with collaboration and intention, there is a path forward. Thank you.
Questions? Senator Tobin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not necessarily a question, just an emphasis on your last point. I really appreciate the reminder that sometimes we have this adherence to quantitative data over qualitative data. And, you know, just reflecting again on that number 73, there's many communities in Alaska have less than 73 people in them. So it's something to really think about when we try to use only the data to justify actions. We miss the stories. So thank you.
Other questions? Senator Geese.
Can we applaud?
We certainly can.
Thank you. Thank you.
Senator Kaufman, I'm surprised here we have this talk about systems and systems engineering. I'm surprised you have no questions. I really want to appreciate Ms. Griffiths for coming and talking with us. It really does highlight the very person-based, and it's a reminder that our children are our greatest resource. And,
thank you.
We can't forget that. So, and I would note that she has been very available, her contact information. She is a wealth of information. I would encourage, I know she's very engaged in this process. I would certainly, as the department moves forward, to the extent that you are looking for resources in the community, she might be even willing to help us here in Alaska. But thank you very much. You've got the light on the question, but really appreciate your coming down and coming down on your own dime to present to us today. Then the last thing we have is we have on Teams, we have we have Shelley Ibanal, CEO of the Foundation Health Partners, which for those of us that really don't know what that's the folks that own the Fairbanks Memorial Hospital, Denali Center, and the Tanana Valley Clinic. The specific reason that we asked Ms. Ibanal to participate is because I have learned that they are part of their request on capital funding, but it's specific to this particular area about how do we provide kids' mental health, particularly inpatient. They've got a request that relates to the Fairbanks Hospital and trying to get more inpatient beds for kids. And so we're going to allow her to make a presentation and just let us know which slide we're on, and we'll keep forwarding through. Because I think it provides some context. I know we've heard about Anchorage and Matsu trying to get kids' beds up, but this is the Fairbanks component of the picture. So if you want to, Ms. Ibanal, if you want to put yourself on the record and proceed with your remarks.
Thank you very much, Chairman Klingman. I want to thank you today for the opportunity.
State your name. You have to state
Shelley your name. Shelley Ibanal. Oh, sorry. Am I echoing there? I'm echoing here. Sorry.
Just I'm turn Shelley off Ibanal, your computer and you won't Chief. Echo. I mean, not turn off your computer. Maybe it's your phone, something. Sorry. Sometimes people are on Teams and have it somewhere else in the background and it starts echoing. But that may not be the case.
Am I echoing for you or just for me?
No, you're fine with us.
Okay. Thank you again. My name is Shelley Ibanal. I am the Chief Executive Officer for Foundation Health Partners. We are the operator of Fairbanks Memorial Hospital, Denali Center, and Tama Valley Clinic. I thank you for the opportunity to address the Judiciary Committee today. First, as you know, the DOJ investigation, although a new twist, it's not a new problem. We have had several investigations, or I will call them reports, all with the same results, but we haven't been able in Alaska to move the ball. I want to reinforce, as our previous speaker said, at the heart of this problem are children in crisis, and there are children. Earlier this month, Foundation Health Partners held an Interior Pediatric Behavioral Health Summit. Next slide. We had great attendance, 56 attendees from various organizations and partners across the interior. I want to give special thanks to Deputy Commissioners Lasley and Ritchie and their teams. They all attended and were active participants in our Behavioral Health Summit. Next slide, please. As you can see on the continuum of care for the interior, this is just for the interior, basically, you can see where the gaps are. We can visually see that we have substantial gaps in residential and stabilization treatment for our children. FHP is proposing an adolescent behavioral health unit and an expansion of our adult unit, but we can only do this with the help of the state. Next slide, please. Next slide. We have a capital request that we would like to make. As you can see, we believe that this will cost us an additional capital of $5.4 million. We are asking the state for $3.4 million of that capital. We'll make an additional request to the Alaska Mental Health Trust and the Rasmussen Foundation for the rest of the funds. Next slide, please. The pediatric gap in services that we see, the average length of stay for our pediatric patients in our emergency department is approximately 115 hours. That's days. Emergency departments are not conducive environments for appropriate evaluation and psychiatric treatment for children. Almost all of the patients that we see would qualify for treatment in a pediatric inpatient unit and could avoid transfer outside of our community or outside of our state. There are no adolescent inpatient psychiatric treatment care units for children in the interior or in northern Alaska. Next slide, please. FMH sees about 350 unique pediatric patients with a primary diagnosis of behavioral health. Each of these children need multiple days of care. Patients stay in our emergency department and our case managers search for appropriate treatment and care. I just want to point out here that this is a huge moral dilemma for our staff and has caused great concern with our emergency department. Providers, as Senator Geisel knows, providers don't go into healthcare to watch children or to watch patients suffer. They want to treat patients, and this has been extremely stressful for our providers. Almost all of the patients qualify for adolescent inpatient behavioral health. FHP estimates that each patient would have a length of stay between 4 to 7 days, creating an average daily census of a minimum of 3.8 patient days. From the unit that we're proposing would only have 4 beds. This would almost immediately fill the unit that we're proposing to build. Next slide, please. This picture should disturb all of you. This is our emergency department seclusion room. This is, as Dr. Dunlap, one of our psychiatrists likes to say, this is where we warehouse the children until we can place them. This is a rubber room and it has no amenities in it, but it keeps them safe until we can get them where they need to be. Next slide, please. We have also seen adult service gap. So over the last 3 years, the acuity of our adult behavioral health patients has increased. More patients require our intensive unit versus our immediate unit. And what that means for us is we have 4 beds in the back of our unit that are for patients that can't mingle with other patients. So we call that our intensive unit. And we are seeing more patients come into the emergency department that need that acute care. So we cannot move them up to our behavioral health unit due to limited beds. We also want to say that that placement is hard across the state. So if we can't move them up, most likely we aren't transferring them to API or other sources. Next slide, please. We do believe that Crisis Now and the 23 stabilization have been helpful, but we also have not seen a decrease in our inpatient unit. As you can see from the chart, the red line is for our intensive unit in the back, and it is full almost all of the time. We rarely have an empty bed in the back, and our inpatient stays census has been pretty stable also, and actually, as you can see, has been increasing. The next slide, please. How we feel like we can make this work. We feel like, as Dr. Zink said, and we believe this too, the solution for this has to be all of us. This isn't just a state problem. This is a community problem. These are all of our kids. And we need to be part of the solution. But being part of the solution is also difficult. As you know, we have many workforce challenges. If we just were to open a new unit, we wouldn't be able to staff it right now. So what we are proposing is to build this 4-bed unit right next to our inpatient unit because we can share resources. All of our psychiatrists are already child psych boarded, so they can take care of children, and we aren't using them for that at this moment, and that's a waste. We also propose opening 2 new unit beds in the back so that we can get those acute patients out of the emergency department. Whether you're a child or an adult, the emergency department is not a proper place for treatment. So I want to thank the state for all their help. I want to particularly thank the administration. They have come to the table. They are helping us try to resolve this problem, both from an operational perspective, and I'm really hoping that the state can help us from a capital perspective. So thank you for your time, and I look forward to partnering with you on improving the care for our children in the state.
Questions from members of the committee? Okay, I don't see any. Oh, Senator Geisel does have a question.
Well, I don't have a question, Mr. Chairman. I have more of a comment. What Ms. Ebenall has presented, I think, has, and the previous presenter, have have done. I believe all of us sitting on this committee have been moved by this information today. Now, Mr. Chairman, I'm not a member of the Finance Committee, but I know how hard they're working to fund these kinds of things. Mr. Chairman, handing $2,600 PFD check to one of these children that need this kind of services does not get them those services. But if the state were to restrain the size of that dividend and use that remaining money to fund these kinds of improvements in delivery of services, makes all the world of difference for all of us, Mr. Chairman. So that has nothing to do with the question, but it has everything to do with how we fund these services and meet the needs of our citizens.
And I would just note, in having this presentation, we do have one Finance Committee member with us today, and I have no intention to try to supplant the essential role of the Finance Committee in making these decisions, but I partly wanted to have particularly the Fairbanks presentation because I think it highlights in coming up with a plan for the long term from Department of Health and the different plans they're working on. Part of that really is the capital investment, that some of that is, I mean, if because we really are on the path of we contract out this work, one of the ways we do that is we provide capital support so that in other regions of the state we have the facilities so that people can come and work there and provide those very services. And everything Senator Giesel says about where are we spending the money, I agree with 100%. So any other questions, comments? I don't see any. I really appreciate everyone coming. And I, again, appreciate it all. We are going to adjourn for the day. Our next meeting is Friday, April 28th at 1:30 p.m. We will stand adjourned. The time is now 2:53 p.m.